Okay, we're beginning here on the middle of Chav Bet Amud Aleph. The Gemara here is discussing what we started at the bottom of the previous Amud, which is that Ula Bar Rav had a question of Rava, which is on Rosh Chodesh, how do we structure the laning? We're supposed to get four aliyot out of the laning, and we have a limited scope of psukim that we can utilize for the laning. How do we break it up to make it work? Now, the mere fact that Rava responds to Ula Bar Rav and says, Zulo Shamati, I didn't hear about this, but Koyotze Bashamati, but I heard something similar, shows you that there was not necessarily a fixed practice about how to lane on Rosh Chodesh, because otherwise Rabbah should have just known it from the fact that they lane that way in the Beit Midrash. Instead, he brings a Gemara that we saw in Tanit with regards to how they split up the laning for the Mamadot. And that is because in the beginning of Breishit, where they read from Maaseh Breishit each day of the Mamadot, the first day they read from Breishit and Yehirakia. And Breishit has five psukim in it, and Yehirakia has three psukim in it. So the same problem, how do I divide that up into three aliyot without violating the principle that is going to become more apparent in today's daf, which is that one is not allowed to leave less than three psukim in a parshia, and one is not allowed to start with less than three psukim in a parshia. And that's because of gzera mishum anichnasim v'ayotzim. We're afraid that if somebody walks in and sees you starting with less than two psukim away from the beginning of the parshia, they will assume that the previous aliyah got just two psukim. And then they will make the mistaken assumption that you don't need three psukim for someone to get an aliyah, and vice versa. If someone finishes off an aliyah with less than two psukim left, if someone then leaves the shul at that point in time, they will be led to think that possibly the next aliyah was just going to be two psukim because that's how much is left until the end of the parshia. And again, they'll make the mistaken assumption that you do not require a minimum of three psukim for an aliyah. For those reasons, we have to now come up with a solution when you have a breakdown of psukim that doesn't allow division by three in order to come up with the proper aliyot. So here with regards to the Mamadot, we said that the five psukim, you have two choices. Rav's option is that you read Aleph, Bet, and Gimel for the first aliyah, then you repeat Gimel for the second aliyah, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, and then for the third aliyah, you read Vav, Zayin, and Chet, which is the next section, next parshia. So that would be the solution according to Rav, which is called Doleg. We repeat one pasuk in order to get three psukim for each aliyah, despite the fact that we were going to end up with a problem, which is that the aliyah, the split between the first and second aliyah, you're going to end less than two psukim away, and you're going to start with less than two psukim away. Nevertheless, that's the best solution we have, and that's what Rav suggests. Shmuel, on the other hand, has a solution that says, I don't want to do what Rav said, because I'm going to then violate that principle of leaving less than two psukim at the end, and beginning with less than two psukim. So my solution is to take pasuk gimel and split it in half. Say that we'll stop halfway through the pasuk. The first aliyah will be 2.5 psukim, and the second aliyah will be 2.5 psukim. That's called pulsik, which is that I divide up the pasuk, and then the third aliyah will be vav zayin and chet, the next parshia. Rav does not like Shmuel's position because he says kol pasuk to lo paskinen Moshe Rabbeinu. Any pasuk that was not divided by Moshe Rabbeinu, we don't have a right to come and arbitrarily divide it. That could be read in one of two ways: either that that's not allowed to divide it up; it's improper. It's something that we are not empowered to do. Or it could be that splitting the pasuk up doesn't do anything for you, because when you read 2.5 psukim, you didn't read 3 psukim. And when you read 2.5 psukim again, you still didn't read 3 psukim, and then you didn't accomplish what you wanted, because reading half a pasuk is not the equivalent of reading a full pasuk, and therefore you have not met the minimum standard of reading 3 psukim for individuals. Shmuel, as we noted already before, doesn't love Rav's solution because it leaves 2 at the end or 2 in the beginning, and the gzera mishum nechnasim yotzim makes it that we don't want to do that. Now, the Gemara then, based on Rava's suggestion, lifts that and says, we'll do the same thing by Rosh Chodesh. By Rosh Chodesh, to solve a problem, we'll either be posek, like Shmuel, we'll split a pasuk in half, or doleg, we'll double up a pasuk. We already discussed at the end of yesterday's daf the different opinions of how that works exactly by Rosh Chodesh, and we'll discuss it again when we get a little further down today's daf. Gemara also spoke about a dispensation that was granted to Rav Chananya Kara, the Malame Tinokot, from Rav Chanina HaGadol, who permitted him to break the psukim up into smaller component parts, not into the full pasuk, in order to make it easier for the young children to learn it. But that was because of a extenuating circumstance in order for the children to learn, but otherwise we would not permit it. And Shmuel says about that, just like that was an extenuating circumstance that was permitted, so too our situation here is that we're left with no choice, and therefore it's an extenuating circumstance where we have to allow the pasuk to be broken in half. The Gemara now begins with Meitave. We have a question from a Braita that speaks about laning in general, that says, Parshasha Shisha Psukim, if you have a Parshia that contains within it six Psukim, Korim Ota Bishnaim. You can split that up into two Aliyot, one of three Psukim, one of three Psukim. Bishel Chamisha Psukim, Biyachid. But if you have a Parshia that contains five Psukim, which is a problem that we're dealing with here, both with Rosh Chodesh and with regards to the Mamadot in Breishit, you have a Parshia that has five Psukim. So when you have five Psukim, the Braita says, then you have to have only one Aliyah. You can't break it into separate Aliyot because you don't have sufficient number of Psukim. Now, Kara Rishon Shlosha, if it happened to be that the first one read three Psukim, Hasheni Koresh Shnayim Miparsha Zo, then the next one reads the remaining two Psukim out of those five, V'chad Miparsha Acheret, and then one Pasuk from the next Parshia in order to make up his three Psukim. So this is less than an ideal situation. But somebody made a mistake and read the three psukim and stopped. That was the first aliyah. So now the second aliyah needs three psukim. He'll get the two that remain in the parshia, and then one from the next parshia, and that'll comprise the three psukim that he needs. That's the view of the Tanakama. Yesh omrim, but there's an alternate view that shlosha, that in the next parshia, he reads two from the remain of this parsha and three from the next parsha. She'ein matchilim parsha pachot mishlosha psukim. Because wherever we can avoid it, we don't want to go into a parsha just one pasuk. We want to go three psukim into the parshia so that we don't have this problem of someone thinking that you started less than three psukim away from the beginning, that someone else got the previous aliyah was less than three psukim. Vimita, according to the answers that we had before, the mandamar duleg niglog, according to Rav, who says that you repeat a pasuk, why don't we repeat a pasuk here? Mandamar posek nifsok. And according to Shmuel, says that we split the pasuk in the middle, then you should split the pasuk in the middle here as well. Now Rashi claims that the Girsa of the Gemara is incorrect, and that the question here is only on Rav, because the situation is a bidiavad situation. They already read three psukim. There's nothing more that you can do at this point to say split the pasuk in half. Shmuel's solution is only an a priori solution. It's a solution before the fact where I know already that I need to have five psukim split into two aliyot. But here where I have five psukim and he already read three psukim, you can't go back and split the pasuk. And therefore, it's not a question on Shmuel, because Shmuel in this case would not say to be posik. It's only a question on the one who says doleg, which is Rav. So why don't we go back and repeat the last pasuk of the aliyah, of the first person's aliyah? And that way we could have the five psukim covered. We take the three that the first one read, now go back and read the third pasuk again, and then read four and five. And then that would solve the problem. Why are we just continuing on reading two psukim and then reading into the next parshia? So that sounds like there's a different solution to the problem, and we don't permit doleg. We don't allow you to repeat psukim. Tosfot says that even according to Shmuel, there is a problem, because Shmuel says when you have the opportunity to be paskinan, that's what we do. But absent that choice, he would also agree with Rav that you have to do something, and therefore he would also say doleg. And that goes back to what is the machlok between Rav and Shmuel. They both posit possible solutions to a difficult situation, and they're both subpar, so how do I know which one to pick? So the Rashba claims that the machlok between them is, what do I put the emphasis on? According to Rav, the people coming to the shul late and leaving early are not so common, and therefore it's not such a big deal to have an exception to the rule in this case, where we double over a pasuk, even though it starts less than two away and finishes less than two away. Nevertheless, it's still a better solution than doing something that's totally out of the box, which is splitting a pasuk in half. But Shmuel says that, and if they are surprised by the issue, they'll ask questions about it. That's what we'll see later on in the Gemara. Shmuel says that people's tendency is not to ask questions. They just go off with their own assumptions, and they come to the wrong conclusions. And therefore, better to do something that's out of the box, like split the pasuk, so that people know for sure that we're doing something unusual. And since it's unusual, they would then ask questions about it, or figure out what's happening here because of this unusual circumstance. Now, in a case where that option is no longer available to Shmuel, then he definitely would agree with Rav that you do doleg, because that's another solution. He just prefers his solution, but if he doesn't have his solution, he thinks that Rav's solution would work as well. Therefore, the Baal Tosafot suggests that the question is on Shmuel as well, even though it's not about posek, but it's about doleg nidlog. That question applies both to Rav and Shmuel. And then the Ritva makes a suggestion that the question applies to both of them, and that's based on where you think the question's from. Right now, we think that the question's from the latter half of the Braita, which is someone who read three psukim out of a five pasuk, parshia. What do we do once we get to that situation? In that case, Rashi says, posek is no longer relevant. Doleg is the only thing you're going to ask a question about. Then the mitzvah says the question's from the first part of the Braita. First part of the Braita says if you have a parshiyah of 6, you read it with 2. And a parshiyah of 5, you only read it with 1 individual. According to Rav, why can't you read 2 individuals with 5 psukim? According to Shmuel, why can't you do it? You have the solution of Poseik or Doleg. How come we don't use that solution? Why does the Braita not even consider that solution? To which the Gemara answers, Shaina Hatam, the Efsher Bahochi. That in that case, where we're talking about regular laning, like on a Monday and Thursday, you have a safety valve. The safety valve is that you can keep reading in the Parshiot. And as long as something is topically relevant, you can keep reading Psukim to fill in the deficit that you have. Our problem is that by the Mamadot, we only want to read the first 2 days of creation, and therefore we're stuck with the Parshiot 5 Psukim, Parshiot 3 Psukim, and we can't go past there because that's the next day's leaning. If that's the case, now I have to come up with a solution with the limited resource of psukim that I have. Same thing by Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh, I'm limited because I have the Parshat HaTamid that has 8 psukim. I have the Parshat of Shabbat, which has 2 psukim, and the Parshat of Rosh Chodesh has 5 psukim. I can't go past there because the next psukim deal with Pesach have nothing to do with Rosh Chodesh. You're not going to read past that point. That's not true on your classic Monday and Thursday where you're reading the beginning of the Parshat HaShavua. So if you make a mistake or you only have 5 psukim in a Parshiyah, and then somebody makes a mistake and you have to read onward, or you can't offer another aliyah in those 5 psukim, then you're just going to read on in the parsha. And that's totally permissible. So according to the way that Rashi views it, the question comes in the latter half of the Braita, then the solution to the problem is that we keep reading in the parsha. That's the solution that's brought by the Tanakhama and by the Yeshomrim, just how much further you read in the parsha. That's a better solution because you have the option to continue laning. And that'll be your solution. That's your safety valve. According to the Ritva, the question is, why are the 5 psukim only 1 aliyah? Because you have an option to bring in a second aliyah from after the 5 psukim. You have more to read. There's no limit in what you can read because you have a whole Parshat HaShavua that's still topically relevant, and therefore you have the ability to add on psukim, which is not the case by Rosh Chodesh and by the Mamadot. The locha is like the Yeshomrim, which means that when it comes to a parshiyah of 5 psukim, if someone makes a mistake and stops after 3 psukim, then the next aliyah is the remaining 2 psukim in that parshiyah, and you must read at least 3 psukim into the next parshiyah. Now, Rabbi Tanchon and Rabbi Shimon Levi say about the Yeshomrim, similar to the fact that they say over here that you must start at least a minimum of 3 psukim. They also say you may not finish off with less than 3 psukim left in a parshiyah. So now we have the statement which Shmuel leans on for his opinion, which is, just like we don't start a parshiyah less than 3 psukim away from the beginning, so too, when it comes to parsha, we don't leave over less than 3 psukim. Mar says pshita. Why would you think otherwise? Because hashta uma adchalta the kamekel tanakama. When it comes to the tanakama about starting a parshia with less than 3 psukim, he is totally fine with that. That's because he says when you have this situation where you have 5 psukim, the first one read 3, the next aliyah you give him the 2 psukim at the end of that parshia, which you're forced to do because they've stopped incorrectly, and then you just read 1 pasuk into the next parshia. So he allows you to start a parshia without going 3 psukim in. Machmire Yeshomrim. In that case, the Yeshomrim say, no way, you have to read at least 3 psukim into the parshia. Shiur, leaving over less than 3 psukim to Machmir Tanakama, where the Tanakama himself says you can't do that, and that's the first part of the Braita, where it says that if you have 5 psukim, you can only put 1 aliyah there. So it's clear that he believes you can't leave over less than 3 psukim, and he's Machmir there to say no way. Yet when it comes to the beginning of a parshia, he says, 3 psukim, you don't need to go in. You can just go in 1 pasuk. That's not a problem. So then, lo koshukein de machmire yeshomrim. And certainly the yeshomrim, in a case where they don't allow you to start with less than 3 psukim, then certainly they're not going to let you end with less than 3 psukim. So you can see from the Tanakama, the fact that the Tanakama is more machmir about leaving less than 3 psukim over starting a parshia with less than 3 psukim, then certainly the Yeshomrim, who are machmir for starting with less than 3 psukim, then certainly they're not going to allow you to finish with less than 3 psukim. So Gemara explains, why would you have a havamina to say otherwise? Madutema, nichnasim shchichei, yotzim lo shchichei. It's more common for people to come late to shul or walk in the middle of laning than it is to leave in the middle of laning. The manche sefer Torah v'nafke. People are not comfortable just walking out and leaving the sefer Torah open. That's disrespectful. So people might come late. That's a more common occurrence. But here, leaving is a less common occurrence. So therefore, the Yeshomim might say, when it comes to reading three psukim at the start of an aliyah, that we're going to make sure that you read full three psukim into the parshiyah for the nichnasim, the people coming in, so they see that you've covered three psukim. On the other hand, for people leaving, that's a rare occurrence. So maybe we won't worry about leaving less than three psukim in a parshiyah, and you can even do less than three. Kamash malan, that we worry about both of those, despite the fact that the yotzim are less common than the nichnasim. Nevertheless, we still worry about both, and therefore we're careful to not start with less than three psukim in a parshiyah, because then the next individual who comes in is going to think that the previous aliyah was two psukim, or the person walks in the middle of the aliyah, according to the Ritva, might think that this aliyah started at the beginning of parshiyah and is only two psukim, and we don't leave less than three psukim, because somebody who's leaving might think the next aliyah is going to be less than three psukim if you leave less than three psukim. The Tanakama, Maishna Shure Delo. So now we have to understand the Tanakama's logic. He says you're not allowed to leave less than three psukim in a parshiyah. That's why he says when you have five, you can only have one aliyah. B'shem Yotzim, because of those people that leave early. Atkulei Nami, why do we allow you to start less than three psukim into a parshiyah? Because he says you just add one pasuk for the next parshiyah and you're fine. Why don't we say there, Atkulei Nami, gzera mishum nichnasim? Why don't we have a gzera for those that are coming in late? Amre, manda ayil shu'ulei shayil. The person who's coming in has the whole tzibur in front of him. If he's wondering or perplexed about what they just did, or he thinks it's strange, he'll just ask. And he can ask people to ask because he has a audience there of people who are in the shul. And we'll clarify for him that we don't do less than three psukim, and that the reason that we went a little bit into the next parshiyah is because we already read two psukim from the previous parshiyah for this individual. On the other hand, the person who leaves has nobody to ask. And therefore, once he's left, he is going to go off with his assumption that the next aliyah is less than three psukim and never clarify it, and then you'll think you can have an aliyah at less than three psukim. Shalach le Rabba Brei de Rova, the Rav Yosef. So Rabba, the son of Rova, sends to Rav Yosef, Hilchata mai, what's the alocha? Shalach le Rav Yosef sends the alocha back, Hilchata doleg, b'emtzei dolgan. So this is what we went over at the end of yesterday's daf, that the alocha is like Rav and not like Shmuel, that we repeated pasuk, and the one who repeats the pasuk is emtzei dolgan. Rashi over here says that that is referencing to the mamadot, that the Gemara here is discussing the mamadot, and this is the conclusion with regards to mamadot, and therefore it's not conclusive with regards to Rosh Chodesh. That then leaves open the question as to what we do with Rosh Chodesh. That's one possibility. Other Rishonim, like the Rif, and many of the Rishonei Ashkenaz believe that the Gemara over here is addressing Rosh Chodesh as well. And that is because generally you don't have the Hilchata L'Meshicha. The Mamadot are only relevant when the Zman of Beit HaMikdash is Kayam. And since the Beit HaMikdash was already destroyed when Rabbi Yosef and Rabbah are discussing this, then why would they speak about Halacha that deals with the Mamadot? They were obviously speaking about Rosh Chodesh because that's the practical Halacha. That must be what they're speaking about. On the other hand, the Ramban claims that that's not necessarily true, because we have Hilchata L'Meshicha when it has ramifications or hashlachot to a practical halacha. And that's one of these instances here. Because whatever you conclude with regards to the mamadot, even though it's not going to be practical, it has implications for practical questions like Rosh Chodesh. How do we deal with Rosh Chodesh? And therefore that raises the issue as to what is the proper conduct with regards to Rosh Chodesh. And we discussed that yesterday, that the Rif's opinion is the way that the Ramah paskins, which is that when it comes to Rosh Chodesh, the Kohen gets the first three psukim, Aleph through Gimel. The Levi goes over the third pasuk, pasuk Gimel, and he reads Dalet and Hey as well. Then the Yisrael reads the remainder of the first parshia that has eight psukim, which means that there's three psukim left there, which is Vav Zayin Chet. And then he reads Tet and Yud of Yom HaShabbat. And then the final Aliyah, the Yisrael again, for Rosh Chodesh, gets the last five psukim from Uvrashei Chod Sheichem. That's the breakdown that the Rif suggests. He noted that the Ramban was upset about the Rif's solution because of the fact that even when you're delayed there, when you start the second aliyah, you're leaving less than two psukim from the beginning and you're not solving anything. And so therefore the Ramban thinks that maybe you should just read four for the first aliyah, four for the second aliyah, then it'll be Yom HaShabbat, two psukim for the third aliyah, plus one pasuk into Roshei Chod Sheichem, and then the last aliyah will be the remainder of Roshei Chod Sheichem. And even though you're going to run into a problem of leaving over a pasuk, he says, well, better not to be doleg and repeat a pasuk and then just be in violation of starting to a parsha with less than three psukim. That's less of an issue than you, the Rif, who's doing doleg and still has the problem that you're starting a parsha, you're less than two psukim from the beginning. So he says, I like my solution better. And what about the fact that the Gemara here says doleg? He says, like Rashi, that doleg means with the mamadot. That's not necessarily a solution for Rosh Chodesh. You can come up with other solutions for Rosh Chodesh. And then we noted the Graz solution that is found in Masechet Sofrim, which avoids the problem that the Ramban raises with the Rif, and still does doleg, which is that the first aliyah is 3 psukim, the second aliyah is 5 psukim, so you finish off the tamid, then the third aliyah repeats the last 3 psukim of Parshat HaTamid, and then reads 2 psukim from Yom HaShabbat, and then the fourth aliyah is Rosh Chodeshchem. So the Gra finesses out of having ever someone start less than 3 psukim away from the end of a parshiyah, or finishing off less than 2-3 psukim away from the beginning of a parshiyah. He never has that issue because of the way he does it. The problem or the weakness in the Graz position is that it doleg in the Gemara seems to indicate a repetition of one pasuk. Over here, the Graz is having you repeat 3 psukim and not just one pasuk in order to get the minimum 3 psukim you need for the third aliyah. But obviously he thinks that's preferable than having the problem of violating the Gzerah, Mishum HaNichnasim, Umishum HaYotzim. Now Tosfot over here raises a number of issues with regards to some of our practices. One of them that he raises is with regards to reading on a Tanit. He says that with the reading on Tanit of Vayechal, that starts less than 2 psukim away from the beginning of a parshiyah. So the Tosfot says, well, that's an issue. How come when you come in and you start Vayechal, you have less than 2 psukim before that, and now people are going to think that you can have an aliyah that's less than 2 psukim. So the same thing is true on Chol HaMoed Pesach. After the first day of Pesach, when we read the Korban that's brought every day on Pesach, we don't start from Chodesh HaRishon, U'b'chamisha Asar, B'yom Rishon Mikra Kodesh, we start from Yikrav Demishe Ola Hashem. And he says, well, that's also within two psukim of the previous parshiyah. So Tosfot gives an answer, which is that since it's a fixed structure, people aren't going to make a mistake. The truth is that they are unlikely to make a mistake because this is the first aliyah. And so most people are going to be aware, even if they walk in late, that this is the first aliyah. And therefore, they'll have no mistaken assumption or be misled to believe that the previous aliyah was less than 2 psukim. So that's Tosafot's answer, that when you know something is done in a certain way all the time, people already know that that's the situation, and they're not going to make a mistake about it. Or they'll know that we're starting there, and therefore there's no previous aliyah. Many of the Achronim point out that what Tosafot's questions don't even get off the ground, because in our Sifrei Torah, when it comes to Chol HaMoed Pesach, Vikravtem is the fourth pasuk after the beginning of that parshiyah. There are 3 psukim, and then Vikravtem is the fourth pasuk. And the same is true with regards to the parsha Vayechal. In our Sifrei Torah, Vayechal is 4 psukim away from the parshiyah. There's no parshiyah 2 psukim away from it. So the issues that are raised by Tosafot, even though he has an answer for them, nevertheless, in our Sifrei Torah, the way that we have the parshiyah, the Ptucha by Vayechal, and the Stuma by Parshat Pinchas for Chol HaMoed Pesach, both of them are 3-4 psukim away from the parshiyah, and they don't present a problem for us. Tosafot then raises the issue with regards to Chol HaMoed Sukkot, which is then much more difficult issue, and that is, number one, in Eretz Yisrael, we read the same aliyah over and over again 4 times, which is the equivalent of doleg. And we said that you can only do doleg when it's absolutely necessary. Why is it necessary there? Maybe you could read other days from Chol HaMoed, and that would be at least topically relevant. So why do we keep repeating the same aliyah? And in Chutz La'aretz, where we discuss at the end of Gemara and Sukkah about the different opinions, the way the Be'alei Tosafot lay out, and the way that we pass from the Ramah, which is slightly different, but basically on the same trend, is that on the first day of Chol HaMoed, you read Yom HaSheni for the first aliyah, Yom HaShlishi for the second aliyah, Yom HaRevi for the third aliyah, and then you repeat Yom HaSheni, Yom HaShlishi for the fourth aliyah. So you're again repeating something that you already read beforehand. Tosafot doesn't really answer the question here, but for Eretz Yisrael, you could answer that they only read the relevant day of Chol HaMoed. The fact that we don't deviate from that at all shows that we only want to read that day, and maybe that's considered to be as if EFSHAR. There's no other possibility because we only want to read that day. In Chutz La'aretz, where they have a little more flexibility because they already have a Sveika D'Yoma, so they're already going to read 2 days, then they let a little more go and they read a third day, which is not relevant to this topic, but then they go back in the fourth aliyah and read the first 2 days again. And that might again be for people to know what is the proper days, that it's Yom HaSheni, Yom HaShlishi is the Sveika D'Yoma. Never we go back, we just kept reading and we read of Yom HaChamishi, then it would be difficult to understand what was the real day or the real Sveika D'Yoma that we were dealing with. In addition, when you get to the end, when it's Yom HaShishi and Yom HaShvi'i, you're going to have a much harder time dealing with that, and then you're going to end up having a couple of days where you read the same thing over again, and it won't be clear or identifiable which day it is. So maybe because of those reasons that it's also EFSHAR, that they're doleg, that they repeat the psukim that they read previously for the aliyah, both in Eretz Yisrael and in Chutz La'aretz. And that question about repeating psukim actually comes out to be machloket Sfaradim and Ashkenazim, where in the Kriyat Torah for Shabbat, the Shulchan Aruch in Reish Pei Bet, Sif Bet says, Mutar likrot olim harbei, afo pi shekarazem, ashekarazem, v'chuzer mibarech. You can repeat psukim, even though the person coming up for the next aliyah reads the same psukim as the previous aliyah, when they had special Shabbatot for Chatanim or for other reasons of smachot, that they needed lots of aliyot, you can repeat the same psukim and give an aliyah for the same psukim that were read previously. And there's no problem with that. The Mishnah Berurah does point out that if you wanted to count to the Minyan Shiva, you wanted to count to one of the seven people that you get to get the minimum seven aliyot for Shabbat, they have to at least read two or three new psukim in order for them to be counted as a new aliyah. But nevertheless, according to the Shulchan Aruch, that's not a problem to repeat psukim and have someone come up with an aliyah with no new psukim. On the other hand, the Ramah says, V'yeshu Srim, brings down the Mordechai here in Megillah, who says that we do not repeat psukim and give someone aliyah. You need some chidush, you need something new in the aliyah in order to make a bracha on it and have an aliyah. It says, V'chei nagu b'midinot elu. And that's the practice in Minag Ashkenaz, is that way. Chutz mi'simchat Torah, with the exception of Simchat Torah, shenagu l'arbot b'kroim v'nagu kisvar rishuna, that they have the practice like the Shulchan Aruch, where we read over and over and over again the same psukim and give people aliyot. So that's the only exception that the Ramah grants. He does not say it by the case of a chatuna, where the chatan, and there are a lot of people you want to honor. Nevertheless, he says that one should make sure that there are new psukim in each aliyah, unlike that psak of the Shulchan Aruch. And that's, again, a difference between the Ashkenazim and Sfaradim with regards to calling up aliyot. So Gzera Klal, the Gemara continues with what's said in the Mishnah, Kol she'esh bo musaf, anything that has a musaf, v'eino yom tov, it has an extra korban musaf, but it's not a yom tov, on that day you read four aliyot, ibaluhu. The Gemara asks now, tani tzibur bekama, how many aliyot do you get on a tani tzibur? Now the Rabbeinu Tam notes that even though you should have been able to learn this from the Gemara and Tanit, because the Gemara and Tanit is talking about a tani tzibur, over there by the Mamadot, it says that there are three aliyot. That's what we just discussed earlier on this Amud. Nevertheless, he says that maybe the Mamadot, we're only talking about what the Kriyat, the Torah is for the Mamad. But there might be a separate aliyah, a fourth aliyah that does with the Tanit, which the Gemara and Tanit's not dealing with because that's not unique to the Mamadot. There was just talking about the unique laning to the Mamadot. Maybe there's an extra aliyah for the Tanit itself. Therefore, that's the Gemara's safek here. How many aliyot do you get on a Tanit Tzibur? Three or four? Rosh Chodesh Umoed, Rosh Chodesh and Chol Umoed, we already saw, they get four. Dikra Kurban Musaf, because they have a Kurban Musaf, they're not a Yom Tov, therefore they get Arba'a. Aval Hocha, the lack of Kurban Musaf, over here by Tanit Tzibur, there's no Kurban Musaf, lo, you don't get four aliyot, you'd have the regular three aliyot. Odilma Hachaname Ika Musaf Tfilah. Over here, you also have the addition of a Tfilah. Now Rashi claims the addition of the Tfilah is Anenu, because in the Chazarat HaShatz, we add an extra bracha for Anenu, and that's the Mosaf HaTfilah. Other Rishonim discussed the possibility that the Mosaf HaTfilah was the 24 brachot that we saw in Masechet Tanit, which they used to add on in a Tanit Tzibur, that they used to do 24 instead of 18 brachot. And there are still others that suggest that it's connected to Ni'ilah, that there was an extra Tfilah that was added on Taniyot Tzibur, and therefore the Ni'ilah is called the Mosaf Tfilah. But any one of those, which means that there's an addition to the normal structure of tefillah on a tanit, maybe that then generates a need for an additional aliyah, like the Kurban Musaf does for Chol HaMoed and Rosh Chodesh. And therefore, by tanit Tzibur, you would have four aliyot and not three. And the Ritva and the Rashba ask the same question as the Rabbeinu Tam, that the Mamadot include Musaf tefillah. They have an extra tefillah, and we still only read three aliyot. And they answer the same way that the Rabbeinu Tam does, which is that the possibility that's only about the Mamadot. But maybe there was a fourth aliyah that dealt with the Tanit, that was Vayichal. Tashma, Boshei Chodoshim uvecholosh Moed Korim Arba'a. Our Mishnah says that when it comes to Rosh Chodesh and Chol Moed, you have four aliyot. Ha b'Tanit Tzibur Gimel. You would infer from that, which Tanit Tzibur is not mentioned, only gets three aliyot. Ema Reisha. Well, that's great if you midayik from the latter part of the Mishnah. But if you midayik from the first part of the Mishnah, it says, V'sheni b'chamishi b'shabbat b'mincha, Monday, Thursday, and Mincha and Shabbat, Korean Gimel. There you get three aliyot. So there, the Tanit Tzibur is not mentioned either. So how Tanit Tzibur Arba? You would infer from that that the Tanit Tzibur gets four aliyot. Elamaha leka lemishma mina. From that Mishnah, you can't be medayik anything because Tanit Tzibur is not mentioned. It's not mentioned in the list of three. It's not mentioned in the list of four. So you can't be medayik either way. So Tashma, let's learn it from here. The Rav Ikla de Bavel. Rav came to Bavel b'Tanit Tzibur on a day that was a Tanit Tzibur. Kam krab sifra. They called him up for an aliyah, and he came to read in the Torah. Patach barich. He opened up the Sefer Torah, made a bracha, asher bachar banu, and then began to read the Torah. Chatim, he finished the aliyah, velo barich, but he didn't make a bracha afterwards. Now, fal kulei alma on payu. Everybody else fell on their faces for tachanun. Rav lo nofal al hapeh, and Rav did not do nefilat apayim. So this latter half of this story, the Gemara will deal with at the end of today's daf. Part that they're speaking about now is Rav coming on a tanit zibur to Bavel and laning, but only making a bracha rishona, not making a bracha achrona. Michte, Rav Yisrael Kora. Rav was Yisrael. He wasn't a Kohen, he wasn't a Levi. He was called up as an Yisrael. So the aliyah that he likely was called up for was for the third aliyah. Mai taima chatam velo barich. So why did he finish his aliyah and not make a bracha afterwards? Lav neshum de mikre achrina batrei. Is that because they're going to call up someone else after him to take an aliyah? And the way it worked in their days was the person who opened said the bracha rishona, person who closed said the bracha achrona. So there's another aliyah. There's no reason for him to bring the closing bracha. It could be done by the next aliyah. So Gemara says, lo, Rav b'kahane kara. Rav was called up for the aliyah of Kohen. Daha Rav Huna karei b'kahane. Rav Huna, who was a Talmid Mufak of Rav, and took over the yeshiva of Rav and became the preeminent Talmud Chacham in Bavel after the death of Rav, he, even though he wasn't a Kohen, he got the Aliyah of Kohen. Now, Bishlam Rav Huna Kari Bekane, Da'afilu Rav Ami V'Ravasi Dekane Chashive Dare Yisrael. Rav Huna, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Bavel, he was on a greater level, or he was considered to be a Gadol Ador, even greater than Rav Ami and Rav Asi, who were Kohanim in Eretz Yisrael. And despite the fact that they were Kohanim, they deferred to Rav Huna. Mikav Kaifle, they were subject to his rulings. Rav Huna was such a Gadol Ador that his rulings governed everything that happened in Bavel, not only everything that happened in Bavel, but even that which happened in Eretz Yisrael. And so even Rav Ami and Rav Asi, who were in Eretz Yisrael, who were Kohanim, they were subordinated to the Psak of Rav Huna. So that shows you that Rav Huna is considered to be the uncontested Gadol Ador, even in the face of Talmidei Chachamim Kohanim. And therefore, since Mikav Kaifle, the Rav Huna, since they were subject to his rulings, then he was granted the Aliyah of Kohen, because he's the undisputed, uncontested Gadol Ador, and he goes first, because we have a principle that a Talmud Chacham Mamzer is greater than a Kohen Gadol Am Haaretz. Now when it comes to Torah erudition, the one who's the greatest Talmud Chacham should go first. Now we have a Takana in order to have Shalom and not to have Eva between parties and fighting, that we have the Kohen goes first and the Levi then Yisrael. But where you have a Talmud Chacham who trumps, then we would give him the Aliyah of Kohen and he would supersede all the Kohanim. Now that's only true when it's an uncontested situation. If you have people where it's not clear who is the Gadol Ador, or are going to fight about who's the Gadol Ador, then we do not uproot the Kohen and give it to the Talmud Chacham, because then it defeats the whole purpose of the Takana. It's only that we will uproot the Takana when the giving the Aliyah to the Talmud Chacham will be no different than giving it to the Kohen, because people will not question why you gave him the first Aliyah. So in the time of Rav Huna, I understand why Rav Huna was called up as the Kohen, because he was the uncontested Gadol. Now the Rav, when it comes to Rav, Ha'ikashmol dekana hava v'dabar alei. So by the case of Rav, you have Rav who is the Gadol Ador in Bavel, but you also have Shmuel, who's a contemporary of his, and Shmuel is a Kohen. And Rav used to defer to Shmuel. He gave kavod, he would let Shmuel walk in before him when they went into places. He always gave deference to Shmuel. So if that's the case, we're not going to give Rav the Aliyah of Kohen. And from Rashi, it sounds like the person has to be the uncontested Gadol Ador in the entire region, not just in his city, but in the entire area, because Shmuel and Rav lived in different cities. Shmuel was in Nardal, and Rav was in Sura. Nevertheless, because he deferred to Shmuel's in Kavod, even his own city, he couldn't take the Aliyah of Kohen, because there was a Kohen Shmuel who was greater than him in the region of Bavel or in the country of Bavel. So if that's the case, how can you claim that Rav got the first Aliyah? So Shmuel Nami Mikav Kaif Le Rav. The truth is that Shmuel was subordinated to Rav when it came to Halacha. Rav came from Eretz Yisrael after he got bumped out of Eretz Yisrael because of the altercations there. He had to run away to Bavel. He returned to Bavel. And in Bavel, he was quickly recognized as being the Gadol Ador. And even Shmuel recognized him as the Gadol Ador. So then why is Rav giving deference to Shmuel if he's the Gadol Ador? That's because of an incident that took place. Rav gave deference to Shmuel because of the fact that he had mistreated him in one situation, which we'll discuss in a second. That's only true when Shmuel was there, did he give him deference. But if he wasn't in front of Shmuel, he would not give deference to Shmuel, meaning that Rav was greater than Shmuel, wasn't a question. Just in front of Shmuel, because he felt bad about what he had done, he gave deference to Shmuel. Now that's based on a story in the Gemara in Shabbat, that when Rav first came to Bavel, he had a stomach ailment. Shmuel was a doctor, and he treated Rav, and when he treated Rav, he gave him some sort of liquid to drink that gave a huge stomach ache, and he didn't allow him to relieve himself, because that was part of the cure. And Rav was in such writhing pain that he cursed whoever this person was that gave him this medicine, and he said that they shouldn't have children. And it turns out in the end that it was Shmuel, who was the doctor who gave him the medication, and he was doing it for his own benefit. And Rav afterwards was sorry that he had said that, because his curse came true, even though he was wrong in applying it. But we saw earlier, and here certainly where it's Kilat Tamid Chacham Shemi Kalam Einecha, even though it was misplaced or is misspoken, it's pretty clear that Shmuel had daughters from other stories that we're going to see later on in Shas, but he never had any sons. And therefore, Rav felt bad because he thought it was because of him that that was the case. Never used to give deference to Shmuel as to kind of make up for what he had done or the wrong that he had committed towards Shmuel. So now Gemara says, Hachanam Mistavra, the Rabbi Kanei Kara. This answer is, makes a lot of sense, that Rav was given the first Aliyah, that he was called up for the first Aliyah, Disak Adadcha B'Yisrael Kara. If you think he was called up for the third Aliyah, Lifanea Mai Taim Mabarich. Why did he make a bracha before he started to lean? Meaning that in the old way that they did it, the first Aliyah made the first bracha, and the last Aliyah made the last bracha. Rav's coming up with Shlishi, and he's the middle Aliyah. Why is he making an opening bracha? The Gemara says, oh, la'achar takana. Rav was only after the takana. After the takana, every person that gets called out for an aliyah opens with a bracha. So wait a minute, if that's the case, then even afterwards you should make a bracha. The takana was, b'shem ha'yotzim and nichnasim, because somebody might leave, somebody might come in, so we make a new bracha for each aliyah, and we make a closing bracha for each aliyah. So if that's the case, why did Rav only give an opening bracha, not a closing bracha? It says, Shani Hecha Deyotiv Rav. It was different where Rav was. I mean, in Rav's yeshiva, or where Rav davened, it was different. The Mele Ayuli. People came in late, but Mipak Lo Nafke. Nobody left. So people came in late, so you need to have a bracha Rishona in order to be sure those people came in late can hear the bracha Rishona. But with regards to a bracha Chrona, you don't need to do that because nobody left early. And so therefore you can't prove anything from the fact that Rav made a bracha beforehand and not afterwards. It could have been because he got the Aliyah of Kohen, or it also could be because he got Shlishi. And we didn't suspect anybody would leave, and therefore, even after the new Takana, he only made a bracha Rishona, not a bracha Achrona, with regards to the Aliyah of Torah. And therefore, you can't prove anything, because we don't know if he got Kohen, or he got the third Aliyah. If he got Kohen, then maybe there were only three Aliyot. If he got the third Aliyah, then maybe there was a fourth Aliyah, because he didn't say a closing bracha. But you can't say for certain, therefore we have no proof from this case of Rav. Beitashma zeaklal kol sheish bo bitul melacha la'am kagon tanit zibor v'tisha ba'av korim gimel. On any day where there's a problem that it will ruin the workday, it will eat into the workday, that we don't have a longer davening and you only have three aliyot. Sheim bo bitul melacha, on a day where people are already desisting from work, sheim bitul melacha la'am, they're already desisting from work, kagon, for example, Rosh Chodeshim v'chol moed, for Rosh Chodesh and Chol Moed korim dalit. Then you have four aliyot, Shema Mina. That's pretty conclusive, as Rashi notes over here, that when it comes to a Tanit Tzibur, Rov Taniyot Tzibur, Mutarim B'Malacha, you can do Malacha, with the exception of the rain fast, where the middle rain fast and the latter rain fast, you're not allowed to go to work, but other Taniyot Tzibur, you're allowed to go to work. And he says the same with Tisha B'Av, because we know from the Gemara in Pesachim in the fourth parak that not doing Malacha on Tisha B'Av is a subject to a Minog. It's places that had the Minog, so there's no inherent Yisur Malacha. It's a minag not to do malacha, and therefore it's not a day of Isser malacha. Even though one who does malacha on Tisha B'Av in Uroyama and Siman Bracha, he doesn't see a Siman Bracha from it, nevertheless, it's not something that's inherent to the day where there's an Isser malacha, and therefore since it's a day where there will be Bitul malacha, we only have three aliyot on Tisha B'Av, and only have three aliyot on Atanit Tzibur. Then by Chol HaMoed and Rosh Chodesh, which are days that have desisting from halacha already, then we allow davening to go a little longer so we have a fourth aliyah. As Rashi points out here, that's easy to understand by Chol HaMoed. He mentioned that by the Mishnah as well, because you have Melachet Devar Aved. You're allowed to do some malacha for things that are davar aveid that are going to be losses, but otherwise there's no permission to do malacha. Chol HaMoed is a partial moed, and therefore there is desisting from malacha, and so that makes sense. But on Rosh Chodesh, where do we ever see there is an Isser malacha by Rosh Chodesh? That's one of the character traits of Rosh Chodesh, that it is a moed without Isser malacha. That's what the Gemara in Arachin says when it speaks about Hallel on Rosh Chodesh, why there's no Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. It's a day that has a musaf, but has no Isser asiyat malacha. So where does the Gemara come off saying that Rosh Chodesh is a day that's not bitul malacha le'am because people are already desisting from work? Tosafot over here says it, and Rashi says a similar thing, that it's dealing with the women. The women who have a minhag not to do malacha on Rosh Chodesh, therefore there's not a extreme bitul malacha on the day because part of the population already is not working on that day. The women have taken upon themselves not to work on Rosh Chodesh. And Rashi quotes the Midrash as well as Tosafot, that the women did not participate in the Chet HaEgel. When their husbands came to them to give their jewelry or donate their jewelry to the Egel, they were unwilling to give it up. They stood fast by HaKadosh Baruch Hu and said, we're not going to worship the Egel. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as a reward for that, gave them the Rosh Chodesh, and they're resting from Malacha, or not doing Malacha on Rosh Chodesh. As Rashi says over here, Amrula and the wives said to their husbands, Atem rotzim lasot pesel masecha shein bo koach latzil. You want to make this idol that has no power to save us? V'natan HaKadosh Baruch Hu scharan shel nashim ba'olam hazeh. God gave them a reward in this world, she'e mishamrot roshei chodeshim yoter min hanashim, that they will keep Rosh Chodesh more than the men, meaning that they will have a minhag not to do malacha as opposed to the men. U'olam haba hein atidot itchadesh kmo roshei chodeshim. And like we say in Kiddush Levana, v'la levana amar shetitchadesh ateret tiferet le'amusei boten, she'em atidim litchadesh kamota. That the humans are going to litchadesh like the moon in the future, like techiyat ha-meitim, so to the women will hitchadesh kmo roshei chodeshim in olam haba. And so therefore they were rewarded with that. The problem with that is that the women aren't generally the ones who go to shul. They're not the ones dealing with the laning. So why is their Isser malacha impactful or influential in having four aliyot on Rosh Chodesh? Therefore Rashi brings here at the end that the pasuk in Shmuel Aleph, where David HaMelech does not show up to the meals with Shaul because he's afraid Shaul is going to kill him, and Yonatan and he make the pact to see what Shaul thinks, and they have this whole secret wave through the shooting of the arrows, which is the Haftorah from Achar HaChodesh. Over there, it says that they had 2 days of Rosh Chodesh. So first of all, that's problematic from the outset, which is in the time of the Mikdash, where they did a Piyariyah. Why do they have 2 days of Rosh Chodesh? Because it says on the first day, Shaul was not suspicious of David's absence because he thought he was Mikre Laila, he was Tameh, and he couldn't come to eat the Korban. But on the second day, he says, why isn't he here? And then he challenges Yonatan, and then he gets mad at Yonatan that he allowed David to escape at the cost of David HaMelech being the one who's going to now supplant Yonatan as the king of Israel. And Shaul is trying to kill him to stop that. So he gets angry at Yonatan, and then Yonatan goes out and tells David that he's got to run away because Shaul wants to kill him. So in that story, it says that it was the day before Rosh Chodesh, because we read the Haftorah of Machar HaChodesh, and that means that the day that they were speaking was Erev Rosh Chodesh, and the Targum of that day is Yom Chola. It's a day of Chol. So as opposed to Rosh Chodesh, which is not a day of Chol, Yom Chol means a day of work. Implied from that Targum is that Rosh Chodesh was not a day of work. So Rashi says, based on that, it seems to be that there was some practice not to work on Rosh Chodesh, and the Turei Evin makes a suggestion that he thinks in the time of the Beit HaMikdash that Rosh Chodesh had a different status, and then at the time of Beit Mikdash, there was actually an Isser Malacha on Rosh Chodesh that doesn't exist today because we do not have Korbanot, and that the Korban Musaf, which was the Korban of all of Klai Yisrael, and a special Korban by Rosh Chodesh, generated an Isser Malacha. So again, Rashi, Tosafot, and other Rishonim speak about the minhag of women not to do Malacha. Rashi brings the alternative, which is also found in the Rabbeinu Yonatan, that there was a broader practice of men and women not to do Malacha on Rosh Chodesh, but only the women continued it after the Korban HaBayit. Or there's the Turei Evin, who said that there was a full-fledged Isser Malacha min Adin when the Beit HaMikdash was extant. And after the Korban HaBayit, the women carried on that practice of the minhag, again, because of the reward for their not participating in the Egel. So now the Gemara concludes from this Tashma, this Braita that we just brought over here, that with regards to Tanit Tzibur and Tisha B'Av, it's pretty straightforward that you only have three Aliyot and not four. So Amar Rav Ashi, V'anan lo t'nan ochi. Our Mishnah seems to indicate otherwise, meaning that I would come to a different conclusion than the Braita that you just brought. Zeklal, our Mishnah brings a principle at the end. Kol yom sheyesh bo musaf, Veino Yom Tov, any day that has Musaf, or Korban Musaf, we think, Ve'enu Yom Tov, but it's not a holiday. It doesn't have Yisra Malacha. Korin Arba'a, Latuye Mai. What does that come to include? Lav Latuye Tanit Tzibur V'Tisha B'Av. Isn't that coming to include the days of Tanit Tzibur and Tisha B'Av? Because, as we'll see in a second, there's nothing else to include. We already mentioned explicitly in the Mishnah, Chol HaMoed and Rosh Chodesh. So they can't include those days. So what's the Zeh Klal coming to include? It must be coming to include something else. That something else must be a Tanit Tzibur and Tisha B'Av, which would imply that our Mishnah thinks you have four Aliyot. Mar says, Ravashi Matnitan Mani. According to Ravashi, who's the author of our Mishnah? Lo Tanakama, Velo Rabbi Yossi. It's not the Tanakama, not Rabbi Yossi, the Tanya of the Braita that speaks about Tisha B'Av. Chaliot B'Sheni V'Chamishi. If Tisha B'Av falls out on a Monday or Thursday, Korim Gimel. According to the Tanakama, you have three Aliyot. Umaftir Echad. And the Maftir is the third Aliyah. He is the Maftir. B'Shlishi U'B'Rivi. If it falls out on a Tuesday or Wednesday, Korei Echad. You have one Aliyah, Umaftir Echad. And the Maftir is the one who got the Aliyah. So there's one Aliyah that's both the Aliyah and the Maftir according to the Tanakama. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Lo'olam Korim Gimel U'Maftir Echad. Rabbi Yossi says, we always say that you have three Aliyot and one Maftir. Now Tosafot over here discusses, how do you know that when it says Maftir Echad, it's one of the three and not the four? So Tosafot says that based on the Tanakama's position, because according to the Tanakama, it's clear that on a Tuesday and Wednesday, there's only one Aliyah. And if you say Maftir is a second Aliyah, it's less than a normal Monday and Thursday. So then when Tisha B'Av falls out on a Monday and Thursday, the Tanakhama is not going to say that it has more Aliyot than a normal Monday and Thursday. So therefore his three Aliyot on Monday and Thursday must subsume within them the Haftorah. And so therefore on his Tuesday and Wednesday, so too, the one Aliyah must subsume the Haftorah. And just like by the Tanakhama, the Maftir is subsumed in the Aliyot, so too for Rabbi Yossi, who only argues with him with regards to Tuesday and Wednesday, he's going to say the same thing. Because Rabbi Yossi Omer, Lo'olam Korim Gimel Maftir Echad. You always have three Aliyot and one Maftir. And so his Maftir is one of the three. So according to that, there's nobody who thinks that there are four Aliyot on Tisha B'Av. Velikasha. So then what are we going to do with the Zeh Klal? Lo'olam Atuyi Rosh Chodesh U'Moed. The Zeh Klal is not coming to include Rosh Chodesh or Chol HaMoed. Ha'be'ejek Tani Lo'ab Roshei Chodeshim U'Moed Korim Arba'ah. The Mishnah explicitly mentions that Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed get four Aliyot. Mar says, Simana Ba'alma Yehoiv. The Zeh Klal is not coming to include something extra. It's just a memory aid. It is just to help you consolidate the situations in which you have four Aliyot. There's a Klal. Here we give you a principle to follow. Now the Bavli, in most cases with the Mishnah, every time it sees a Zeh Klal, it thinks it must be adding something more than the Mishnah had. The easier reading of the Zeh Klal is that the Mishnah is coming to summarize and give you a principle that you can lean on for the details that it explicated on. And that's what the Gemara here concludes when it has no other choice, that that's a Zeh Klal. But in other places, the Bavli is set, I'm ensuring that they know what the Zeh Klal comes to include. And the reason that you need this Siman HaBa'alma is the Lo Tema, so that you don't come to the conclusion, Yom Tov v'Chol HaShemoed Ke'adadininu. Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed are the same. Ela Nakud HaKlal HaBiyadich. Remember this principle, called the Tafile Milta Mechavre Tafile Gavre Yetera. Any day that has something more than another day, it will also have some extra Aliyah. Hilkach, Barosh Chodesh V'Chol HaMoed, Tikur Kurban Musaf. So it has the extra of the Kurban Musaf, not Yisra Malacha, Korin Arba, you get four Aliyot. B'Yom Tov L'Asur Basilat Malacha, Yom Tov adds on, besides the Kurban Musaf, Yisra Malacha, it's a Moed, Chamisha, you get five Aliyot. B'Yom HaKippurim, that has the same thing as a Yom Tov, but the punishment for violating Yom Kippur is Karet, as opposed to the violation of Yom Tov, which is a Lav. It also has the fact that Yom HaKippurim, there is no Heter Ochel Nefesh, which is not true by Yom Tov. So therefore, Shisha, you have six Aliyot on Yom Kippur. Shabbat, that has above Yom HaKippurim, not only the Yisr Malacha, but the Yisr Malacha is subject to an Yisr Skila, then Shiva, you get seven Aliyot. And so that's what the Zeh Klal is coming to do. It's just setting down the principle that since Chol HaMoed and Rosh Chodesh have something above a normal day, they get one extra Aliyah. But they're not as good or as great as Yom Tov, therefore they only get four and not five. Gufa. So now the Gemara goes back to the story of Rav and says, Rav Ikla Bavel B'Tanit Tzibur, Kam Karo B'Sifra. He got up to read, he got an Aliyah. Potach Borich. He opened up the Sefer and said a Bracha Asher Bachar Banu. Chatam, when he finished the Aliyah, lo borich, he didn't make a bracha achrona. Naful, kuliyama on payu. Everybody else fell down onto the ground to say, tachanun to do nefilat tepayim. Rav lo nafal on him pay. And Rav did not fall on his face. My time a Rav lo nafal on pay. Why did Rav not do nefilat apayim? So the first possibility is, ritzpa shalem minim haita. It was a stone floor. V'tanya, and the Braita says, V'evin maskit lo tudu v'artzichem, l'shtachavot ala. You're not allowed to have a stone floor upon which you bow in your land. Ala yata mishtachaveh v'artzichem. You're not allowed to bow down to it in your land. V'alata mishtachaveh alavanim shel Beit HaMikdash. You're allowed to do it on a stone floor in the Beit HaMikdash. The idea of the Braita is because you might have thought that the Evan Maskit is only a restriction inside of Eretz Yisrael. So the Braita comes to clarify for you that Artzachem is not Eretz Yisrael. Artzachem means anywhere you live. Because Artzachem comes to exclude Beit HaMikdash, not to exclude Chutz La'aretz. And therefore the Evan Maskit restriction applies anywhere except for in the Beit HaMikdash. Kidula, which is similar to Ula's position, Damar Ula, Lo Asra Torah El Ritzpah Shel Avanim Bilvad. The Torah only proscribes the ability to bow down on a stone floor. And so therefore, since it was a stone floor in the shul where Rav was, he didn't do Nifilat Apayim because he couldn't fall down on the floor. That was a problem because of the law in the Torah. Where it says, Yochi, Mayiri Rav, Afilu Kulu Nami. Wait a minute. If that's the case, why did Rav was the only one who didn't do Nifilat Apayim? What about the rest of the congregation? Why did they do Nifilat Apayim? So, Kamei the Rav Havai. The stone floor was in front of Rav. So the area which was a stone floor was right by Rav. Anywhere else, it was carpeted, or it had some other flooring, and therefore it wasn't a problem. So, Liza Legabe Tzibura. So why does the Rav just move? He can move from where he's standing, where there's a stone floor, to where the rest of the Tzibura is, where there's no stone floor. Lipol Alapayim, and then he can do Nifilat Apayim. Lobay Lemitrach Tzibura. He didn't want to bother the Tzibur, as Rashi says over here. If he went out to the Tzibur, everybody have to stand up for his kavod, and that would interrupt the Nefilat HaPayim. So Rav felt it better to stay in his place, not do Nefilat HaPayim, and avoid the problem. V'ibay Tema, another possible reason why Rav didn't bow down was because Rav Pishut Yadayim Raglayim Havavit. That Rav, when he did Nefilat HaPayim, he used to prostrate himself out completely flat. Ukidu Ula, and like Ula's qualification, Damar Ula, Lo Asra Torah, El Pishut Yadayim Raglayim Bilvad. That the only restriction by the Torah's lav of Em Maskit Lo Tudu Be'artzichem, Ula already qualified that, said that's only by stone. And his second qualification about the Din Doraita is that's only true when you fully prostrate yourself. So that's the restriction, and Rav was trying to do Pishut Yadayim Raglayim. That was his practice. So Mar says, Lipol Alapeh, V'lo Lavi Pishut Yadayim Raglayim. So today, modify that. Don't do the full prostration. Just bow down and put your head to the ground. Lo Mishanei Miminagei. He preferred not to change his minhag. Now, from this second piece over here, the combination of the two positions of Ula, I tell you that the Isur Doraita is only when you do Pishut Yadayim Raglayim, only when you do a full prostration. And it's on Avanim, and it's on stone outside of the Mikdash. That's the only time it's an Isur Doraita. The second answer seems to imply that the problem here is he's doing Pishut Yadayim Raglayim on stone, and that was the problem, because he was then going to be in violation of an Isur Doraita. But that implies that in the first answer that the Gemara gave, that when it's a Ritzpat Avanim, that maybe there's an Isur Derabanan for doing something that's not Pishut Yadayim Raglayim, because the Gemara never qualified or never stated that that's what Rav was doing in the first case. It just said he was doing a Filat Apayim. And if you assume not like the second answer, that it was Pishut Yadayim Raglayim, but simply a Hishtachavaya, that would imply that Rav believes that there's an Isur of Hishtachavaya, of bowing down on a stone floor, or there's an Isur of doing Pishut Yadayim Raglayim on a non-stone floor. That's the way the Loch is brought down, which will discuss at the end of today's sugya. V'ibay Dema. Now, there's a third possibility as to why Rav didn't do Nefilat HaPayim is Adam Chashuv Shiny. An important person is different. This is something we saw in the Gemara in Tanit and Daf Yud Dalet, which is Kid Rabbi Elazar. The Amar Rabbi Elazar, En Adam Chashuv Rashadi Polo Panav. An important person is not allowed to fall down on his face, do Nefilat HaPayim. Elim Kein Ne'aneh Ki Yoshua Binun. Unless he's answered like Yoshua Binun, Dichtiv, because the Pasuk says, by Yoshua Binun, after the defeat at the hands of the Ai, he falls down in front of Hashem, and he davens to Hashem, and it says, Vayomer Hashem al Yoshua, Kum lach, get up, and then instructs him what he needs to do. Now Rashi over here says that Yoshua was doing the wrong thing, that he shouldn't have been nofel al apayim, and that's why he tells him, Kum lach, get up. As Rashi says over here, Lamazata nofel al panecha, Alma en lo lasot, you shouldn't have done this. So only if you were certain that you're going to be answered, should you do such a thing. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Kanano says, Kol mi shipol al panav, veinu kasher ki Yoshua. That is not as kasher as Yoshua, she'im yipol al panav, yolar min ha-shamayim kum lach al yipol, that he'll get a response telling him, get up and don't fall down, meaning that it was a positive. Yoshua was the example of somebody positive who was answered, that Hashem told him, don't fall down, get up. If you don't have that confidence that if you and you go down to do nefilat at the bottom, they're going to tell you to get up, and they're going to respond to your tefillah, then you shouldn't be doing it. Or others point out to the contrast between Yoshua and the remainder of this Kenim. That obviously this Kenim fell with Yoshua, that Hashem only responds to Yeshua. And so since he only responded to Yeshua, that shows you that unless you are certain you can be responded to, you should be not fall down, as opposed to this Kenim, who did the wrong thing because they weren't asked to stand up or that Hashem did not respond to them. As Tosva points out over here, he qualifies this from the Yushalmi. His restriction only applies when he's davening on behalf of the Tzibur. Aval ben Ol ben Atzmo Shapir Dami. If it's his own private tefillah, if it's himself, that's not a problem. So the question or the issue seems to be that if the Tzibur is relying on this individual for the tefillah, then in order for him to embarrass himself and demean himself and to quote a Torah, he should only do that if he's certain that he's going to be answered, because otherwise it will diminish or demean his standing in front of the congregation, because they're going to say this person can't get the response that he needs to get. And then the people will curse him or not treat him properly, or it's a problem of Chilul Hashem, that this person who supposedly presented themselves as a Talmid Chacham is not able to get answered by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So a person should only fall down in that manner if he's going to get the response that he expects from the falling or doing the Nefilat HaPayim, because that way the Tzibur will respect him like they did by Yoshua Binun. Now the question is here, and we're going to answer this in a second again when we come to the end of the Sugya, whether this is only true when a person does Pishut Yadayim Raglayim, if he prostrates himself, or is this true of any Nefilat HaPayim, that it is problematic if the Gadol or the Adam Chashuv does it and he's not going to be answered. Now the Gemara goes on to a segue and then we'll come back to this topic. Tan Rabbanan, Kidah, whenever the Torah speaks about a Kidah, Alapayim. That means that the face is touching the ground. Shnema batikod batsheva apayim aretz. That Batsheva put her face to the ground in front of the king when she approached the king about anointing Shlomo Melech as the king. Kriya al birkayim, bowing down is on your knees. V'cheinu omer, it says by Shlomo HaMelech, after he finishes giving a tefillah for the dedication of the Mikdash, says, V'kam mikro al birkav. He gets up from bowing on his knees. So you see that kriya is on the knees. Hishtachvaya, bowing down as a hishtachvaya, zo pishut yadayim raglayim, that's prostrating oneself, shinemar, because that's what Yaakov says to Yosef about the dream, havo navo ani vimcha v'achecha l'hishtachvodecha artsa. Artsa means that you're flat out on the ground. So the hishtachavot is pishut yadayim raglayim. The Tosfot says he's not sure why the Gemara brought these proof texts, because there are alternate texts that seem to say otherwise. He says, lo mikoch hakraw mei pikla. The Gemara has this as a mesorah, not from the psukim, daktiv nami in Ishayahu. It says, apayim eretz hishtachavodecha, that they will bow down unto the land in front of you. So it sounds like that, hishtachavaya means putting your face to the ground. Elhochi gomer le mirabei. This is the mesorah that they have, and that this is the right pasuk to associate with each of these events. But Marashah points out that maybe it's not mukhrak what the Tosfot says, because hishtachavaya, by definition, includes apayim. In subsumed in hishtachavaya are the other things. You have to have a kriya, you have to have apayim ala aretz, and you have pishut yadayim raglayim. It subsumes all the others. So when Yeshayahu says that when you're going to put your face to the ground when you do hishtachavaya, that's true as well. And it's not to the exclusion of the fact that that is pishut yadayim raglayim. It's just taking or speaking about one component of the prostrating oneself that is also included in hishtachavaya. Now the Gemara brings here the story that we just saw recently in Tanit and Daf Chaf Hei. It's also found in the Gemara in Sukkah, which is Levi achve kidah kameh de Rabbi bitla. Levi performed a kidah in front of Rabbi. He was injured. He became lame. He limped afterwards because he dislocated his hip. The way Rashi explains it over here is that this kidah was bowing down one's face to the ground without ever supporting one's weight, which is that the person bowed down, their face to the ground, and they put their thumbs in the ground just to hold themselves up. But obviously the thumbs have no support, they're not strong enough to lift the person up. And then once the person's touched their face to the ground, they have to bring themselves upright again. And in bringing themselves upright, all the pressure and all the strain is on their loins, on their waist, because they're going to have to pull themselves back up without the help of their hands. And that pulling back up is what caused the dislocation of his hip. So the going down or bowing down was not the difficulty, because the one just goes down and puts their face to the ground. It was then the uprighting of oneself where they had to straighten their body out, and now they only have their thumbs in the ground, so there's nothing giving them support to push their weight back up. That means if they pull themselves back up through their trunk and their waist, and that causes the dislocation of his hip. And we know that Levi was very tall, so that might have exacerbated the situation. In the Gemara and Sukkah and in Tanit, it sounds a little bit like the fact that he was doing some sort of push-up where he's able to jump down and touch the ground with his face and then pop back up just on his thumbs. meaning that all this strength was done again from the center of his body that he went down and came back up. But from the way Rashi describes over here, his feet didn't leave the ground on the way down. It was just the uprighting of himself that caused the problem. And the Gemara says, "Bahaka Garmele," that's what caused Levi to have this injury. Person should not speak improperly towards a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Shadam gadol yitiach dvarim klapei malo. Someone, this is a reference to Levi, spoke inappropriately towards a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Vita, he became lame. He was injured by that fact. Umanu, and who is that? That's Levi. And that's based on the story that is told in Tanit, that when the rain wasn't coming, Levi says to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, it's as if you went back up to the Shemaim and forgot about us. So he was saying things that were very harsh towards a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that he didn't bring the rain. And therefore, Rabbi Elazar believes that he was punished for speaking in such a brazen fashion towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he disappeared now, is hanging up in the sky, and doesn't listen to us anymore. So my answer is, like it did in all these other places, ha v'ha garmale, that both are the cause. The reason that Levi was punished is because of the way that he spoke towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he punishes, he does it in a time when a person's already in a precarious position. And the Kedah put him into a precarious position. So while he was in a precarious position, Hashem punished him for that which he had done and spoken inappropriately. So now, Amar Rav Chiya Ba'avin, Chazina Lula Abai V'Rova, I saw Abai and Rova, the Matzle Atzluye. They used to go onto their side. So Rashi claims over here, Altzi Dehem, Velo Noflim Apneem Mamash. They didn't do straightforward Nefilat Apayim. Fishen Adam Chashuv Rashadi Polo Panav. Because a person's not allowed to do Nefilat Apayim. Rashi sees this statement about Abai and Rova as a continuation of the Gemara previous to this, not about the Braita that we just brought, about bowing down, but the previous Braita that said that Ein Adam Chashuv can't do Nefilat Apayim. So Abai and Rova solved that problem by doing it on their side, not doing a full Nefilat Apayim. And that is the source for the way that we do Nefilat Apayim today, where we do it in a sort of adjusted or modified Nefilat Apayim. And they do the modified Nefilat Apayim to overcome the issue of Adam Chashuv. That's the way Rashi reads it. But there are other Rishonim, again, as we pointed out before, who noted that there's a problem of Ishtachavaya on a stone floor, even if it's not Pishut Yadayim Raglayim, or Pishut Yadayim Raglayim prostrating on a floor that is not Abanim. That's a Takana D'Rabbanan from the first answer that we saw. Based on that, that's what many of the Rishonim believe that Abai and Rava were coming to solve. They weren't dealing with the Adam Choshev issue. They were dealing with the problem of Abanim or Evan Maskit. How do they avoid the problem of bowing down on a stone floor, doing a Nefilat Apayim, not Pishut Yadayim Raglayim, or doing Pishut Yadayim Raglayim on a non-stone floor? How do they avoid that Issur D'Rabbanan? Their answer was, Dematzle Atzluye. They used to lean on the side. And that's the view of the Rosh, that it's speaking about the issue of Evan Maskit. And the Halacha, the Shulchan Aruch brings both of these issues down in Kuf Lamed Aleph, because he points out in Kuf Lamed Aleph, Now, Gulato, Kishinel fell al panav, when he falls for Tevilat Tapayim, he does it on his left side. As the Rav points out, that's only at Mincha time when he's not wearing tefillin. But in Shachri, where he's wearing tefillin on his left arm, he should favor his right arm to tilt in that direction so that it's not a bizur de tefillin, except for lefties who always then fall on their left arm because they have tefillin on their right arm. And so both by Shachri and Mincha, they'll fall on their left side. And that same Siman, Kuv Lamed Aleph Sifchet, he says, "Ein adam chashuv rashai lipol panav kishmitpalel al tzibur." So that's like Tosafot says when he's diving for the tzibur. Elam kenu batuach sheaner ki Yoshua ben Nun, like our Gemara says, "Haga." And then the Ramah brings down here, "Chen asur lechol adam lipol panav bivshut yadayim raglaim." A person cannot do prostrating at all. Afilu ein sham evne maskit, even if it's not a stone floor. Aval imnotek tzat al tzido, if he leans slightly to his side, mutar, then it's permissible. Ve'em sham even maskit, if there's no stone floor there. Meaning that the way around the problem of non-stone floor to do pishut yadayim raglayim is to tilt to your side a little bit. V'chein yasu b'yom ha-kippurim, and that's what you do on Yom HaKippurim. K'eshe noflim al pneihem, when they fall down, the way Rishabura says that the Ramah should say, O yatziu sham asavim, ve'lafsik ben hakarko, that they should have something that sits between them and the karko. So you have to do one of two things. Either you do pishut yadayim raglayim on your side, on a non-stone floor. So you do prostrating on your side, on a non-stone floor. Or you do a regular bowing, not prostrating, on a non-stone floor. And how do you create the non-stone floor? By putting something in between you and the ground. So according to this, this is what Matzle Atzluye was coming, like the Rosh says, to modify the issue of Eved Maskit, and to tell you there's an Issur Derabbanan when it comes to Pishut Yadayim Raglayim, even on non-stone floors, you have to then tilt to the side, or even on stone floors, there's a restriction against bowing, even if it's not Pishut Yadayim Raglayim, and then you have to put something in between you, and that's what the Rama says on Yom Kippur, we put something in between us in order to avoid that Issur Derabbanan that's mentioned here by the Rosh and by the Tshuva HaRivosh. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Chav Gimel Amud Aleph.